our friend Colin Fleming. His new book is out right now. You should get it. It's fantastic. As always, it's called Sam Cooke, live at the Harlem Square Club, 1963. Hello there, Colin.
Hey, what's up, Kimball? I think I should, I'm going to call you A-Frame, because you're the man who always brings his A-game. That's what I'm going with today.
Oh, there's some C days, some D days. You know, it's Tuesday. I have to shine on Tuesday. I have to rise to the occasion when you join us.
Yeah, you do, or I'll be disappointed in you. And you know how that goes.
I know, and I couldn't do that. I couldn't live with myself.
I'm not a man who currently possesses a great heaping of forbearance either. So, yeah, step it up, Big K.
All right, well, let's talk about J.J. Audubon then. And Wood Ducks, which, thanks to you, I happened to read for the first time. And, wow, what wonderful and beautiful writing this was. I had no idea.
Yeah, that's the operative phrase, isn't it? You had no idea. Because I don't really know who does. He's one of my favorite writers. I think people hear Audubon and they think Audubon Society. And if they do know Audubon himself, they think his illustrations, which are certainly beautiful, too. But what prose, right? How he's just describing these birds. And he does them all in, well, not all of them, but he does quite a few different kinds of birds in The Birds of America. And he teases out their personalities and their peculiarities and their interests and the way they're wired and the strange things they do and the typical things they do and the things that they might do that other birds don't do and how certain birds, like the blue jay, is really this rake of the forest and also kind of a coward and sort of the Eddie Haskell of birds. And I like the wood duck. It's just one of my favorite animals, certainly one of my favorite birds, because I don't mean to be vain about this, but is there a better looking bird than the male wood duck?
That's a beautiful bird. And Audubon's writing was wonderful because it was, yeah, in many ways, conversational. I'm sitting here and this is what I see. And why isn't that a curious thing? And that was just wonderful. It made me feel like I was there.
He does get so close to nature, too. He'll be out there and he'll just describe to you how he takes a bird in the hand. And sometimes he kills it and takes it back to study it. And that's how he learns a lot of the things that he learns about these birds. But other times he just lets it go. But he knows their nesting habits. All of this. You are right there in the picture with these birds. And you'd think that maybe you wouldn't get a narrative when you're just describing birds. But there's no just about it. These are really short stories. They're these lives. I don't even want to say that they're in miniature. They're these profiles. It's like Citizen Kane, but the wood duck. And the wood duck has different things that it's about than Charles Foster Kane. But you're still getting that sort of biopic that has that narrative thrust. He writes incredibly evocatively and majestically. The prose is, I mean, I love it. I just luxuriate in the way that this person writes. But he's able to see the world in such a way. I've said this before. The world is trying to tell you stories all the time. I don't mean news cycle stuff. I don't mean like Republicans did that. I don't mean anything like that. I mean, when you go out in the way that the mother interacts with her child, there's a story in there if you know how to see it. There's a story in the particular T-shirt someone has on and why they might have it on. There's just story coming at you all the time. I'll just go out and I'll end up with all these stories. And it's not like I've just sourced it directly from the people around me, but the people around me do give me ideas. And I think that nature was that way for Audubon, much like it was for Thoreau. I've been thinking about like powers beyond us a lot lately and where we experience them and where we develop our faith in those things. Like for me, I know that there's something beyond us because I experienced that in art, and I experienced that in my own art. I think for someone like Thoreau and also for Audubon, that you can put whatever term you want to it, whether that's God or just beyond or the infinite, whatever. I think that was in nature. And I think for Audubon, it was really in that avian aspect of nature.
You're also giving me yet another opportunity to score some brownie points with my father-in-law, who, in addition to being a big jazz fan, is also a birder.
It sounds to me, Kimball, no offense to your charming self, that I should be hanging with this man. That we would be quick friends.
Oh, there's no question about it. Yes, absolutely.
If my life ever changes, you can host me for a visit. And we will go over there. And if it goes really well, I will I'll be off your hands. I can just stay there.
Well, or you get the whole package, and you get his daughter, my wife, and the boy. And well, good luck with all that.
Yes, I could step in and oversee the boy's education. I would be willing to do that for. I'm not expensive. If you give me like a couple meatball subs to take home, that's a luxury in my world, and send me on my way with like a bus ticket. That could work out handsomely for all involved. I should forewarn you though, I can't be around a lot of people at once.
I just get
angry.
And I want something in return. I'm holding out for Hallway Hermy.
Go, like you want me to traffic him? That's creepy, dude. Although, you know what?
Simple transaction.
I have to tell you about my hallway, because there's been an incident.
Oh no.
So I have my shoes out there, right? And I have this one pair that's never been worn, and they're winter. It's like snowshoes. And I'm a guy, I'm like the Nook of the North. I won't wear those unless like it's like Blizzard of 78. I have this like nice pair of walking shoes that are fairly new, that are in really good shape. And then I have my disgusting shoes from running stairs. I come out on Halloween morning the other day. Someone had dumped, I mean, they tried to shame me. Someone had dumped white powder into my shoes. And I mean, seriously, two of them were like, one had never, like, new, perfectly new, literally never worn. So, I mean, I figured, I'm not going to incriminate myself in this radio interview, but I figured out who it was, Kimball. And let's just say, put it this way, you wouldn't like how I paid you back. You wouldn't be able to trace it, but you wouldn't like it.
Colin Fleming with us here on Downtown. Let's talk about a recent piece of yours in the Smart Set, smartset.com. A wonderful piece on horror and a couple of short horror classics that are certainly non-traditional, but man, they define horror.
Unintentional horror, and I don't know if things like this are sort of around anymore. One of them is, well, it's certainly still around, this kind of thing, is a nature film by a French director named Jean Ponlevy, and it's just called The Vampire, and it's about this vampire bat and a guinea pig. So there's like a guinea pig in the terrarium. He's like, hello, I'm eating alfalfa. It's a good day to be a guinea pig. And like this bat, like descends. It's all like well lit and everything like that. And you just watch this very creepy, disturbing, methodical scene play out. And the guinea pig is like, don't mind while I eat the alfalfa while you do this horrific thing to me. So like it's narrated. It works really well in French too, where the vampire bat like uses some like numbing agent with its tongue, and it numbs a part of the guinea pig, and it starts removing the hair like it's a barber, like a North End barber.
Yeah.
And it just sucks. It just starts sucking its butt, and the guinea pig is just kind of like chomping away, doing its thing, and it's like you're watching something non-consensual and unholy, but also kind of like okay, I guess, because I don't know. The guinea pig doesn't really seem, maybe expires later that day, but he doesn't really seem the worse for wear, but he's a host. Watching this play out in the lighting, it's very bright. So it's not like here in the shadow corridors of nature. It's just going on right there, and it's like cut to some sort of like scenes from Murnau's Nosferatu, in case you didn't really get what was going on here. But it's quite literally surgical. And it's meant to be this nature film. And nature films, the way they usually work, like if you watch like Nova when you were like a kid or whatever in the 80s, that type of thing, it's the kill is very quick. It's like a lightning strike, thunder, boom. It's like the snatch of the jaws and Hum David or Edinburgh. Wasn't that fantastic? And like you're on to the next thing. But this is protracted. And in the protraction is the horror.
Oh, my God. There's so much tension there. And I'm looking at this. The guinea pig looks like a sweet fellow. My goodness. He loves everybody. And he's like, oh, look, this creature, this bat of some kind, wants to kiss me. And I'm like, no. This is the devil's kiss. Do not just sit there preparing to munch your food. He means you harm. Go. But no, guinea pig just sits there very placid. Oh, I felt something. Well, now I can't feel my nose. What is happening to me?
Oh, yeah. He's just riding it out. It's like he doesn't even know what's happening to it, seems. And it, I don't know. It's, they made me take this out. They're like, you can't say that. You go too far. But I thought it was kind of like a little date rapey, like the way it was happening.
Yes.
Kind of like a roofie sort of thing.
Right.
Except the guinea pig is, he's up for it. Like, he's like, in terms of not up for it, like, let's do this. He's awake. And it's, right. It's like, what's that Velvet Underground song where there's an operation and like the person wakes up in the middle of the operation? That always freaked me out. And it's like the guinea pig is just like, it's fine, just go have a carrot after.
Right. Let me know when you're done. I got some more to eat over here. But something and feels then, funny. Mm.
Then you have the other film is, these are probably still around, the public information film, a PIF, where it's like, okay, we almost sort of talked about that episode of Suspense from last week as though it should have been a radio segment version of a public information film, but it didn't, where it's a cautionary tale, it's a warning or something like that. And we have Donald Pleasance, the guy who was, of course, so just bad at trying to round up Michael Myers in those Halloween films, but this is before that, it's 1973, and he's dressed up as a pseudo-reaper who hangs around really, really sketchy swamps. That, like the swamp at the dump. Like, that's the swamp he's at. I like when the kids get close to the edge of the water. And it's very sort of pedophilic and creepy, and he has this coil, and he loves when kids show off. They're narcissists, and they fall in, and they get tangled in like a tricycle that someone discarded, and they die. And he really, really is into that.
Donald Pleasance is creepy, and he's so good in everything he does, although he's also great in a completely different type of Donald Pleasance in one of my favorite Twilight Zone episodes as the teacher who believes he's outlived his usefulness.
Yes, and how about that episode, too, where he is the Outer Limits, where he's henpecked? And he has mental powers, and he's like that sort of just put-upon guy by his wife. Like, he's not menacing at all. He's almost like TV's version in that era of Peter Lorre, I'd say, where he can go in, like, a couple different of those directions. But in this, like, I don't think when he was making this, like, some people would have remembered him from the 60s in TV, but he hadn't really made his name. He was almost like a character actor at the time when he was doing those episodes who got to have a starring role, because that would happen. You need to have different people. So this would be when he was just kind of this disembodied voice. And one of the kids at one point, so like the Reaper loses his robe, and these kids save another kid from like drowning, sort of. And the kid's cold because they're swimming in the dump pond like in October. And they go to get the Reaper's robe and wrap the kid in. Like, someone's like, ooh, gross. They throw it away. And he's, like, offended. He's sartorially offended. He's like, you don't like my robe? it's a bridge too far that they didn't want to wrap themselves in his just grotty garments and everything. But I don't even think that they were trying to save you from that rusted tricycle. I think this was an attempt to sort of gleefully frighten children with this film that's supposed to be an altruistic service. I mean, it's a very disturbing, creepy film. It's on YouTube. It takes like, I mean, how long is the whole thing? It's just like a couple minutes.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
It is. But it's like, I don't know. It's sort of true to life horror, where you discover horror that you don't mean to discover, that it's not like officially the Frankenstein movie, but it's just like what you come across in your daily life. It's a good reminder that way to keep your head up.
Read Colum's piece at thesmartset.com and then check out those two short films for yourself. Up next, we talk about a very interesting radio production from 1944, the Author's Radio Playhouse of H.G. Wells' The Inexperienced Ghost. I wasn't sure when it started, the music, you know, the organ was a little heavy-handed, and I thought, okay, here we go. But it turned out to be a very entertaining production.
A tip I would give people for most of the mid-century, certainly horror radio programs, listen past the organ. Like, don't get caught up in the organ, because that's just kind of a heavy-handed trapping that many things had at the time. Like a stellar show like Quiet Please doesn't use the organ in quite that way. Actually, they use this strain of classical organ as the theme music, but this is almost like that ballpark organ in a minor key, and it just goes too far. But it's not indicative of what you're going to get with the program. It's just something that's kind of draped over the top of it. And this H.G. Wells story is charming, I think, where a guy's at this club. A lot of ghost stories at the time had like guys at their club, and they're settling a bet or making a bet, that kind of thing. And this one guy's telling the story about this ghost that wasn't able to disappear. It was just kind of hanging around. So he tries to help the ghost out with a way to move forward, to vanish. And they're sort of like friends. I like that idea of being buddies across the world, even sort of like passing buddies, where it's not like Casper, where it's like a relationship falls apart, that kind of thing. It's someone doing someone else a good turn. And I like sort of the metaphor of how that transcends the corporeal world. I mean, I find that heartening. So he helps the ghost out, and it's sort of like this counting, and I like how H.G. Wells, he doesn't like really spell it out for you, but you kind of get this mental picture in your mind as you're listening. And then the guy later, after the ghost has had his problem solved, he shows his buddy what he did for the ghost. And the ghost had like learned it from a mirror, that kind of thing from the guy. So he does it, and he dies. And he thinks he's just going to pop back, but doing this thing on his own with his buddies killed him off. So the ghost shows up again. He's like, oh, no. The guy's like, oh, it's fine. I'm going back in a second. The ghost is like, oh, no, you're not. Sorry, dude. So it's like, I don't know. It's funny. It's sweet. It's sad. I like that kind of admixture.
Yeah, it was very good. The Inexperienced Ghost from the author's Radio Playhouse. Let's talk about a couple of sports topics and begin with the recent piece you did for USA Today on postseason baseball and why it's closer to the baseball that I think you and I both loved when we were younger, that they do the little things, the small things, as opposed to regular season baseball when it's all about what you call the large things.
They do, and I don't want to sound like I'm and the days of Shoeless Joe, I don't want to sound like that, and I've just like popped my teeth back in to make my speech. I'm not talking about like drag bunts and things of that nature. I'm just talking about little things that add up to win, or really just not swinging for a home run on every single pitch. And the way I put it in the piece was every inch of base paths matter. And I recall when I was like watching the 86 World Series that we've talked about, and the Red Sox would get someone on first base. I just would think incrementally, like, okay, a grounder behind the runner on first gets the guy to second. And then a hit to the opposite field, even just a single, and he's surely going to score. It's that simple. And I was just always thinking about the increments and the inch, and you get your hopes up that way. And the way you can create a lessening of that space, the way you can move a runner over, and just doing these small things. And what happens, too, with the small things is that the athleticism of these guys comes to the fore. I think that athleticism is buried during the regular season when it's like your drunken uncle behind the house and he's had like some Bud Light. He's like, I'm Luzinski. And he's like swinging to run it over the house. And I don't really need to see Mookie Betts like that. Do you know what I mean? I'd rather watch Mookie Betts play the way that like his athleticism allows him to play. And someone had mentioned on Twitter that in response to what I put up about this, that you couldn't do that in the regular season. And it's like, why? I mean, the intensity wouldn't be the same, but you can still create runs as effectively as possible. It's not an effort thing. It's a strategy thing.
Right.
Which is completely different. It's not like a greater outlay of energy to do this. It's just sometimes having a bit of a smarter approach.
And we saw this even with the Red Sox, who we've acknowledged were one of the worst fundamental baseball teams in recent memory. But even the Red Sox in the postseason, guys like Martinez and Christian Vasquez would find themselves going with the pitch. And when they were winning, that's what they were doing. They were going to right field, hitting behind the runner. A guy like Christian Arroyo would come up and drop down a rare, well-executed sacrifice bunt.
I agree. It's strange, too, because you see baseball revert to regular season baseball in the postseason only during extra innings. in extra innings, everyone tries to win it with a home run.
Right.
Eventually someone does. And so the game stagnates. But the ratings are so low for this current World Series. I know it's not like anybody's dream matchup, but they go down each year now, and I think the regular season has a big part to do with that. But I was watching that. I didn't have a horse in the race, obviously. That game six in the NLCS, and it was low scoring. I mean, it could have been like the 1959 White Sox and the Dodgers. I wasn't around for that, but I know how they played. It was just, there was more value for each pitch. And I don't mean like get this guy out of here, he's gone three and a third. It just had higher stakes, higher drama. And when you can have little things add up, that means that like each little thing in and of itself is part of a bigger thing. It's like a composite. So it counts for more. And you get up emotionally when one of those little things happen. It's just a more dramatic game with a better pace, even if it probably takes the same amount of time than just watching the ball, Rob Deere style, fly out of the ballpark.
From baseball to football and the greatest Patriots of all time. And you said the five, but of course, we know who one of them is, so we'll really talk about the six. And
2 through 6.
Yeah. Acknowledge that the guy at number one is pretty much locked that down, at least for our lifetime.
Ethan. Yep. yes, so 2 through 6. And it's one of these things where I wonder how many we'll have in a row. And you know what? I haven't really settled on my order. I think like it's interesting to mention guys, too, who wouldn't be there for me.
All right. Well, I'm pretty sure that my, and I didn't really rank them, but I'm pretty sure the first two I name after Brady will be on your list. And we start with the greatest offensive lineman in history, I think, John Hanna.
Yes, I have him number two as well. I think that when you are the best ever at your position and you do it for a pretty long time, which is what he did, I think it has to be you. And I think a real case can be made that he is the best offensive lineman in football. And it's like sometimes when you get into the history of the Patriots, it's surprising how many sort of like best of guys they have for a franchise. I know it, obviously this century is different, but it was just moribund for so long that they have so many sort of like all-time guys at key spots. So yes, I think John Hanna, I have that throwback too. But then people call me Hog and just sort of gets me down about my body. So I don't maybe wear that one unless I've done a lot of stairs that day. But yes, definitely Hog Hanna number two.
Now I've got, and maybe influenced because he recently passed away, but I've got Sam Bam Cunningham on my list.
Whoa. Wow. Yeah. I didn't even have him in my sort of honorable mentions. I have as number, well, two for our purposes. Three, really. I have Gronkowski.
I've got Gronk next on my list, yep. Another guy that revolutionized the position.
Yeah, I think, again, you can make a strong case that he's the best ever at that position. I believe, personally, that his blocking really gets underrated. That was a huge part of their offense, the final Super Bowl that they won with that group. I thought he was as dominant an offensive player as they had at the time during their key stretch and in the playoffs. And he wasn't catching a lot of balls until they sort of like activated that Gronkowski switch during the Super Bowl when they needed him. But I think he's probably the best tight end who's ever played. Yeah.
Now I felt like I needed a defensive guy, and I went round and round. I had three guys, and I'm not sure I've settled on one. But it's between Ty Law and Mark Haynes.
Interesting. See, I have Law, and I would have him next after Gronkowski. I think people underrate how dominant and how important he was, not just as like a shutdown corner and a ball hawk, but he infused the style of toughness via that cornerback position in that team. I'm not sure people remember how physical the Patriots were
in
03, 04. They wouldn't just hit you. I remember that guys like Ty Law, when they were getting off you, would like drive you into the ground again. Like they'd get off via you. And that was an attitude and a swagger and a toughness where he was like a Ronnie Lott, Steve Atwater type of physical player. Well, maybe not to that sort of like decapitating degree, but you know what I mean. And he was also someone who could play the ball and shut down receivers. And he could also score some points. He could go the other way. And then after him, defensively, I've two other guys next, I think, probably. And Andre Tippett after Ty Law. And because if it wasn't for Lawrence Taylor, you would have seen, I think Tippett was the first, he was an all-pro twice in the 80s. But if it wasn't for like Lawrence Taylor, he would have been like a four- or five-time all-pro during that decade.
Oh, yeah.
And then for the guys I've left out, just to give you some idea, Stanley Morgan.
Oh, Stanley Morgan, next on my list.
It's weird to me. It's like Chris Webber in the NBA. He's not in the Hall of Fame. Well, neither of them are. But if Stanley Morgan's not in the Hall of Fame, playing with some of the quarterbacks, too, that he played with, and still being that much of a deep threat when it was such a low percentage kind of pass. It's not like it is now when you can, like, connect on several of those a game. So he's not there for me. I think Rodney Harrison played the safety position as well as anyone I've seen this century, but he wasn't with the Patriots long enough. So Vinatieri's not there for me, even though he made some of the most important plays.
I had Vinatieri on my honorable mention list, along with Teddy Bruschi.
My last guy, see, to me, Bruschi was a complimentary player and one of the best big play guys I've ever seen. But these other players they're Hall of Fame players. And I don't think, or Hall of Fame level in Stanley Morgan's case, I don't think Bruschi rises to that level. But my sixth guy, so for my five, best one would be Richard Seymour. I think he completely changed that. I mean, they didn't win until Richard Seymour's rookie season. I think he allowed Belichick to do so many things, even if it didn't show in Seymour's stats necessarily, that allowed them to be competitive at the level they were. And that early dynasty, I don't think there was a better team in football history than the 2004 Patriots. And Richard Seymour was to that defense, in some ways, what Brady was to the offense. And the whole thing with Brady, like he was a game manager at the time. He wasn't. That's untrue. Brady was never a game manager. He was not a game manager from his first year in that snowball game when he comes out in the second half and he throws it every single play. Game managers don't do that. So they were giving him a lot of responsibility early on. And Seymour was the same way. But they have so many players that are like 1980s Islanders where they weren't maybe like superstars, but they were just B+, A- type guys with all of these other like Hall of Famers around them. And you get into the history of the franchise, and it's like they really have more than you might think.
Oh, yeah.
In the 80s.
Another guy I had on my honorable mention list, because the position was different back then, but he was so good, even though he only played, I think, 7 years with the Patriots, but Russ Francis.
Yeah. You have all kinds of guys like that. And careers were also different back then. And, like, I just remember, like, it was unlikely that someone like Hannah even played as long as he did. And he retired like a young man. I want to say he was like only 34.
I think
and
so.
It was after that 85 Super Bowl debacle. He was gone. But that was like a lengthy career. Like you just didn't really expect someone to be around that long. I think he was an all-pro that last year too. So they had all kinds of guys. And I really like the 1970s Patriots because they're a bit like the 1970s Red Sox. They have all of these cool guys like on the team, and they have that red color going on too, like the Red Sox had for a while. And they're just one of those squads that I would have loved. Oh, the 1970s, late 70s Bruins too, that you would have loved to see win it, and it seemed like they were always a play away or a call away, if you like. And but a lot of fun after they had just been quite bad, and then of course they got bad for a while again, and then they had their big run in 85, and then they were just terrible after that for a bit too. So, but it's a richer franchise than people usually think if they're just sort of cherry picking from the so-called dynasty.
Yeah, I had a lot of fun going through the memory banks there to think of some of my favorites and also those that were the best through the years. So that was enjoyable. Colin Fleming, always great to talk with you. Check out Colin's website, colinflemminglit.com. Subscribe, if you're not already, to the Many Moments More blog, which is blowing up. Subscribe and you'll see why. And of course, get your hands on Sam Cooke live at the Harlem Square Club, 1963. Colin, thanks again. We'll do it next week.
All right, I'll see you, A-Frame.